This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box with me, Dashran Johan. It's no secret that Malaysia has been plagued with issues of racism, religious extremism and xenophobia for many years. And things have been intensifying since GE15, which painted a highly polarised Malaysia. But just how bad are things looking and what can we do about it? Pusat Komas recently released their 2022 Malaysia Racism Report, which aims to document and record incidents of racism, racial discrimination and xenophobia that have taken place in Malaysia last year. So on today's show, I'm going to be unpacking this with Dr. Ryan Chua. He's the Program Director at Pusat Komas. Welcome to the show, Ryan. How are you?
Hi, thank you, Dashan, for the invitation. I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing good as well. I'm very eager to dive into this with you. So I want to start by asking you a big picture question. Where are we today, Dr. Ryan, when it comes to issues of racism and xenophobia?
I think as most of us would be aware, there has been an increased number of incidents of racism, racial discrimination and xenophobia, especially at this present point of time. And I think that is evident in what we are seeing today and also in terms of the report that we have seen the highest number of cases as compared to when we have first started our monitoring 8 years ago. So it's really at the peak at this point of time. It's a surge.
Right. You mentioned two terms there, right? Racism and also racial discrimination. Could you explain what the difference is?
All right. So I think oftentimes when you speak about racism, racial discrimination, there are different connotations, different ways on how people understand things. I would just go a little bit in, not too much in detail, but these are the based on international conventions and international standards. So racism, to a certain extent, based on the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, it states that it's a construct that assigns a certain race or ethnic group to a position of power over the others. So I think that that's where we can see that it involves cultural attributes, economic wealth, involving hierarchical relations, where the superior race exercises domination and control over the others. So that's racism in general, based on the OHCHR. But of course, when it comes to normal conversations, racism is a broader experience and practice, you know, and it includes, like, you know, the use of perpetuation of racist ideologies, prejudice behavior, structural arrangements and institutionalized practices, which results oftentimes in racial inequality, as well as also the notion that, you know, discriminatory relationships between the other groups are justified. And I think that's what racism means. But when we look into racial discrimination, and I think we have to go back into the ICERT. I mean, it was once contentious topic, but it sets clear definition of what actually conforms or what falls under racial discrimination. And racial discrimination here is any distinction, exclusion, restriction, or preference based on race, color, descent, or national ethnic origin, which nullifies or impairs the recognition, enjoyment, or exercise on an equal footing. So basically, if a person is not given an equal opportunity just because of their race, then it falls under racial discrimination. So these are clear demarcation, clear definitions on how we distinguish what falls under racism, what falls under racial discrimination.
Right. In your paper, you talk about how politicians and political parties from both the government and the opposition utilize race and or religion as a tool to make themselves relevant politically. Can you talk to me about the different ways in which politicians and political parties do this?
So we have identified five trends, but before I go deeper into it, our report is actually not an exhaustive incidence of racism, racial discrimination, and xenophobia. Right. In fact, it's based on media reporting, and this is just a compilation of those media reports. So oftentimes there are many more cases which we do not know, which we have not heard of at all. So of course, this is a disclaimer I have to set first before we go into it. But now going back to the topic where you were talking in terms of racial politics, in fact, we have identified five different trends or strategies that politicians tend to use. First of them is racializing incidents. So just to give a brief overview of what racializing incidents is, that you know, if it's a normal neutral event, yeah, you know, and then the politician will say, oh, you know, the reason why this incident is happening is because, you know, and they will just make it a racial thing. So what they will do is that they will racialize the incident, claiming that the incident that has taken place is done because it has an agenda to attack or to fortify one race or religion or to undermine another. So that's how they will racialize, and they will just make statements and say, oh, look, this is actually a racial event, but in actual fact, it's not.
Could you give me an example?
So one example I think was reflected last year was in terms of DAP Perak Chief, our current minister as well, Nga Kon Meng. He actually did mention that there was an evacuation order for an unauthorized temple development. You know, it was an unauthorized, so the Perak State government decided to evacuate them. But he said that it was actually it was an unfair treatment towards the racial minorities, especially to those who are affected by it. So, you know, it's a neutral event.
Right.
But then it was then taken into a racial turn.
Right.
So that's the first mm-hmm. incident, the first trend of racializing incidents. The second one is the propagation of racist ideologies and prejudice attitudes. So this is more in terms of like politicians would oftentimes try to say that, you know, they have their own racist ideologies and saying that, you know, one group is superior than the other and they are there to dominate the others. And it really is a point where they try to justify their ethnocentric composition, you know, to a certain extent, and then to say that, you know, whatever we are doing is not racist. So for one example, past Secretary General Takiuddin has actually mentioned that, you know, he insists that political dominance of the majority group is not racist and unfair. You know, in fact, he said that it's okay for one race to govern the entire country. And in his case, he's saying that it's okay for the majority ethnic group to say, you know, it's fine. But, you know, but in the end, you know, it's not that, you know, it shows a lot of his views that, you know, it's okay for one group to be in dominant over the others. And, you know, when we go back to the definition is that, you know, you're showing domination and control the others. So,
right.
To that extent, you know, it's where we are saying that there's a propagation of certain ideologies that, you know, the Malays or in the case that we are looking at, you know, they are more superior than the other. And that's not something that we want to see, especially in a multicultural nation like us in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. There are three more trends. One more is that, you know, it's calling and echoing for the representation of racial and religious groups.
Right.
So oftentimes when they say that they are representing, they'll say that, okay, you know, you need to vote for me because I'm representing and I would ensure that the welfare of this ethnic group will be taken care of, safeguarded.
Right.
So, yeah, so there's a representation of racial or religious groups, and then there are some who vilify other races or other ethnic groups. So they'll just say, look, okay, this particular ethnic group is aiming to dominate us. And so it's that kind of vilification. And lastly, it's fear-mongering.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a normal message that we often hear during elections, where they will say that, you know, if party X, you know, takes over the country, and then the other ethnic groups will be affected and their rights will not be safeguarded and much more. So these are the five different trends that we've identified in the report, actually.
Right. What would you say, Dr. Ryan, is the difference between playing up racial or racist and religious identity politics or sentiments versus championing issues pertaining to particular groups that may be marginalized? For example, I go back to an example that you just gave, how certain politicians or political parties, they will say, you know, vote for me because I am your race and then I will take care of your rights, I'll fight for your rights and so on and so forth. Where's the line there?
All right. So when we talk about identity politics, I think we have to go back to the definition. So identity politics is more towards the tendency to form exclusive political alliances based on their race or their religion. And it moves away from the broad-based party, which is representative of everyone. And I think in our country, Malaysia, we have seen a lot of politicians themselves saying that they are there to represent racial and religious groups, you know, to a certain extent. And I think that is where it's sometimes we have to question that, you know, what have they done so far in terms of representing these communities? In fact, you know, there are some that say that, you know, we have to champion the issues of a marginalized community. But the question is that, you know, have these political parties, politicians who have been championing and playing these sentiments for a very long time, done what they are supposed to do? In fact, I have a very good example, actually. In fact, I was meeting the marginalized Indian communities last week. You know, it was in conjunction with our program. And what was I found quite interesting is that this is one of the remarks of the community that they were saying that, I think this is what he said. You know, he said, I think it's time that we as a community, we actually don't really bother who our representative are, whether he's of an Indian ethnic or of an Indian descent. In fact, what he was saying that is that as long as I can get a member of parliament or a representative, regardless of what his race or his ethnic group, as long as he represents our issue, I don't mind any of that. So this was kind of like saying that it gives me a wake-up call in the sense that, you know, racial politics, identity politics have not manifest. I mean, like, you know, people are seeing that, you know, for so many years, umpteen years, political parties, politicians themselves have claimed that they are supposed to be the defenders and champions of their ethnic group. They have yet to do anything in regards to that. So, you know, the people themselves are aware of this, and they say that, you know, even if I can get an Indian person to represent the Indian community, how sure am I that he would be actually doing that, or is it just to take care of his own welfare? So that's what we are seeing today, really.
Absolutely. And would you say that for the longest time, you know, these racial and religious sentiments are used under the guise of, you know, we want to fight for your rights and so on and so forth. But ultimately, it just becomes, when it comes to policy-wise and all, it's used to just, you know, enrich yourselves, enrich perhaps the elites of that particular race rather than the working class masses.
Yes, to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was doing some research prior to this, and I was just thinking, this was actually shared by EPF recently, and they were saying that, you know, before COVID, the median savings in EPF is for the Bumiputra communities, 15,500 ringgit. That's a median. After COVID, it has dropped to 4,900. There's a median income, and there's a drop of 70% among the Bumiputra communities. Then after that, they also did share, you know, for the Chinese community, before COVID, their median savings is 45,800 ringgit. After COVID, it drops to 45,200. So it's just a 1% drop.
All right.
And then we look at the Indian community. Before COVID, it's 25,700. After COVID, it drops to 14,900, the drop of 40%. Now, then the question then comes to play in terms of the effectiveness of the implementation of race-based policies. So our country, since 1970, we have a new economic policy, which was aimed to elevate the socio-economic status of the Bumiputra community. And until today, if you look through the numbers that I just shared with you earlier by EPF, the median income or the median saving of a Bumiputra, it's so much lesser as compared to the Indian and the Chinese communities. What has happened to all these policies? And it's for umpteen years. What actually happened? Why are they still far behind? And I think that's a bigger question that we need to ask, really.
On the show with me today is Dr. Ryan Chua. He's the program director at Pusat Commas. After the break, I ask him if politicians reflect reality on the ground or do they shape reality? Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashrin Johan. And on the show with me today is Dr. Ryan Chua. He's the program director at Pusat Commas. And we are unpacking their Malaysian Racism Report 2022. So, Dr. Ryan, it's not just politicians who spew racial and religious rhetoric, right? It's the public too. There's a line in your paper that stood out to me. And the line goes, these expressions demonstrate the deep-rooted view that the majority ethnic group has a position of power to exercise domination and control over others as they are the quote-unquote true owner of the lands. Could you expand on this for me a little bit?
When we look at the report, or even in social media today, you know, when there are any incidents that have taken place, in social media, there will always be remarks, Balik China, Balik India.
Right.
Balik, where actually, honestly, if I'm a person reading that, you're telling a Chinese to go back to China, where exactly, you know? And I think that is a reflection of the reality today, that there's an in-depth view that there's a superiority mentality that, you know, we are the true owners of the land and the others who are staying here are all just migrants and you are all not supposed to stay in this country. So I think that that's quite evident, honestly, in social media or even in conversations today. When discussions become more intellectual and they are unable to say anything, then they will just resort to, okay, balik China lah, balik India lah. So that's how we are seeing that, you know, it's not only politicians. In fact, this is a deep-rooted belief, deep-rooted understanding that even the people, mass public, are actually having this kind of thinking and mentality. In fact, I just wanted to share, prior to this, Komas had an interview just to understand how people actually view themselves to be Malaysians. And of course, in our finding, we found that, you know, it's an ambivalent feeling. But one of the interviewees, which I interviewed personally, was quite interesting. So there was this interviewee in Kelantan. Mm-hmm. She wants to buy durians, you know. And the owner of those durian stores is actually a Chinese.
Right.
And then after that, the workers selling the durians are actually Malays.
Right.
So she wanted to ask for a discount. And this is in Kelantan, yeah? So she was trying to ask for a discount. And of course, the worker said, let me check and ask my tauke. So he went to ask the tauke. And the tauke said, no, we cannot give you any discount. So then the worker said, sorry, my boss said cannot. And then in her mind, she told me in the interview, she said, I was wondering, why did that Chinese person, this is not his land, this is not where he belongs. He's renting our land and he's not even going to give and take and to give us a small discount in buying durian. Yeah, it's really worrying, actually.
Right. Would you say that this mindset is among the majority, or is it a sort of vocal minority who feel this way?
I mean, it's really difficult to estimate and to gauge, you know, because when you look at online, it can be trolls. It can be certain groups of people who perpetuate that. But when you hear firsthand accounts and we understand Malaysians in general, they won't be rude to you, honestly. So we really don't know how to gauge what they are thinking. But in fact, you know, when the ICERT rally happened back then in 2019, that whole hoo-ha. And I was looking at some of my friends in schools. We are all okay. We do not have much issues with one another. When ICERT incident came in, when I saw his Facebook post, his social media post, I got a shock of my life because this is not the person I know. You know, the person I know is like very cordial. He's okay. He's cool with all the other ethnic groups. But then it really reflects that deep-seated belief. So it's really difficult to measure. It's really difficult for us to identify what that person is actually thinking about. But that could be, you know, here already.
Right. I want to ask, you know, would you say that, you know, based on whatever we've discussed right now, would you say that politicians, the way they, you know, their rhetorics, their narratives, especially heading into an election period, what they spew on social media and in parliament, are all of this merely reflections of the real polarized sentiment on the ground, or are politicians the ones causing this divide?
You take two sides to tango.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So I think it's a very complex issue for us to break, but I will just try to discern the differences. Okay. So of course, to a certain extent, politicians themselves have to be blamed because they are viewed as the leaders of the community. They're viewed to be the representation of these communities. In fact, if you realize that under Pakatan Harapan's administration back then, you know, we can see that there has been an increase of the use of race and religion when they are in power. Mm-hmm. And you sad to say, it's perpetuated by the opposition. And it is really organized to a certain extent. There's a strategy behind to just stir incidents, to stir things. And again, we have to take note that race and religion is very strongly embedded and interlinked to an individual because it relates to their identity. So politicians, then, to that extent, tries to reflect the other group to show that, you know, look, they are not taking care of the majority. And it goes back to that five different trends that I was talking about earlier. You know, they try to fearmonger, they try to vilify other races and ethnic groups in the sense of how they can reflect themselves to be the protectors of the land. So that's one. Of course, politicians is one issue. Secondly, we have institutions which also needs reform because we also have certain groups that have been perpetuating hate speech. It has been perpetuating racism, has been perpetuating racial discrimination as well. So, for example, when we talk about education institutions, we have education institutions is very segregated. You go to public universities, it's majority Bumiputra. You can count the number of other ethnic groups in there. But when you go to private universities, it's the other way around. Right. You can count and there's a handful of Malay students. So it's already very polarized that the structure and the institutions that we have in our country today is also very segregated. So you look through civil service, it's majority Bumiputra. And of course, there are minorities who always say, oh, no, we don't get enough opportunities to go into civil service. But let's look at the flip side. Let's be fair. The private sectors, it's dominated by the minorities, the Chinese, the Indians, and the others. So do the Bumiputras themselves get an opportunity in there? So it's a very fragmented kind of situation that we are living in. In fact, one more example is our housing. Let's just be very frank, our housing. Can we count number of other ethnic groups in our taman? Maybe you can have, a Chinese ethnic group. You know, maybe I can count a handful of like 10 Indians in my taman and maybe one or two Malays only. But then you go to a Malay community, it's how many Chinese and Indians. So it's a very segmented, it's very fragmented. And that whole situation actually comes from the divide and rule policy since the British. In fact, that was their strategy back then, to segregate the different ethnic groups. And it's still practiced today. Schools, educations are fragmented. We have 7 different types of schools today. We've got national schools, vernacular schools, international schools, private schools, religious schools, so many choices. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, we see that all these different areas that we are going today, it's all fragmented. And that's a reflection of our community today. So politicians, of course, they do play a role, but the surrounding and the environment that we are living in as well, propagates and strengthens that as well. It creates that environment to a certain extent where, I don't have any interaction with other ethnic groups and I don't even understand other ethnic groups. We don't really understand who our neighbors are actually. This is that reality today that we are having.
In your report, you also talk about racism in education. In an ideal Malaysia, Dr. Ryan, institutes of learning would be free of racism. But as we all know, that is not the reality of today. Through your research, what did you find out about racism in Malaysian education?
I mean, of course, we look at education, we have multiple different education. We got the primary school, secondary schools. In fact, I think there's also certain systemic discrimination happening in education sectors. I mean, initially, the intention of having such institutions was there. It was valid. It was to empower certain ethnic groups and much more. But over time, we begin to question, are they really relevant in our context today? In fact, I mean, of course, when we look at in education institutions, we have to also be very frank. There are also certain teachers in there who are already geared with that cold racist ideologies when they were young. Again, the lack of interaction, the lack of understanding of different ethnic groups, the practices and the cultural practices would also inhibit such practice. Because one example we had last year in the racism report was where a student who was wearing a kurta during Hari Raya, he was actually told that, you punish after that, because you're not supposed to wear kurta. But again, that is a traditional costume. So the question then is that if the teachers themselves are not educated about that and they are not creating that environment which allows that symbiotic relationship, then that is an issue. Of course, there are also isolated incidents where we can see that, there was a case, I think, which was talked about where a lady who was wearing the religious thing and was cut by a teacher after that. And so all of this shows that, our institutions themselves, the people, the players in those institutions themselves might not be racially sensitive. Mm-hmm. They are not culturally appraised. They do not know what are the different practices of the other ethnic groups there as well. So to a certain extent, that is one layer. Of course, when institutions permit and allow such discrimination, is also another issue. Let's answer the elephant in the room, UITM. It has been a hot contested topic. I think this is something that we need to discuss as well.
Right.
So UITM is only exclusive for Bumiputras, right? And there were calls to open UITM to other ethnic groups, but it was met with strong resistance. Once again, the question then is that why is that so? That's why sometimes it's quite funny to see that certain groups will call, look at the other ethnic groups. They don't want to mix with us. They don't want to join public institutions. But when the institutions themselves do not allow that representation, there is an issue. Because let's be frank, the minorities, they'll find other ways to get education. It's in fact, there are many communities or many minorities who are forced to actually sell their homes, mortgage their homes, just to ensure that their children get education. But when our systems and our universities and our institutions themselves are already racially tailored, and already ethnically tailored, and it becomes an issue.
What about employment? I'm just going to share a personal experience and then you can tell me what your research says, right? So while waiting for my STPM results, this was about 10 years ago, I applied for a salesman job at a computer retail store. My Chinese friend of mine was working at the store as well. So now the supervisor hired me. But on the first day of work when I showed up, after a few hours, the big boss fired me out of the blue when he arrived. And I later found out from my friend, because he was eavesdropping on their conversations, that it's the boss was saying that it's because I'm an Indian, and the boss said Indians will steal things. You hear these kinds of things a lot of the times. You know, like we said, like earlier you mentioned, it's not just about the public sector, right? This is clearly the private sector. What does your research tell us about racism in the employment sectors?
In fact, as you have clearly articulated, I mean, oftentimes people will train their hands, guns, and everything all against the public sector. But let's be frank, this is also happening in the private sector. In fact, there are multiple incidents that, I mean, in the racism report, of course, we have captured an incident where a Malay salesperson is getting a lower salary as compared to a Chinese salesperson. And that's not acceptable. Both are given the same, they should be given equal opportunities. And I think, let's also be frank, there are certain private sectors which do not allow the Malay employee to wear their headscarves.
Right.
But it's their own cultural practice. So
absolutely.
Again, this is sometimes that we also need to be fair. Again, you know, of course, oftentimes you aim at the public sector, but of course the private sectors themselves are guilty of doing it. And all of this sometimes, as you have mentioned, you know, in your case that the boss said that Indians are still thinking. Let's be frank, you know, all this goes back towards the environment where that person is raised, and of course in terms of how these different stereotypes and prejudices are formed. Let me just give you an example, right? Why for certain times the Chinese will have that kind of thinking? And I'm pretty sure that this is a Chinese company that you're talking about.
It is.
Definitely, you know. Most of the time, I mean, I don't want to say this, but as a Chinese I can say, you know, like, you know, most of the when they are young, these Chinese children when they were young, the parents would tell them, if you are naughty, I will get that Indian uncle to come and catch you.
Right.
So, like, what would happen to the child, you know? Immediately in his mind, the Indian person is a scary person. The Indian person is a dangerous person. Try not to associate anything with that person. So, again, you know, parents themselves are guilty. So, they are perpetuating racism when they are young. So again, you know, let's be frank, you know, in such situations, it's not only the majority. Oftentimes, we train our gun on the majority. But even the minorities themselves, I can say, you know, some of the parents will say, oh, all Malays are lazy. They will get all government assistance, you know. And how? I mean, in actual fact, looking at the data I just shared with you, you know, the Malays are also slugging. They are also trying their very hard to live. And that's the thing, you know, these stereotypes are all shaped by the different environment. And of course, it's always a very clustered kind of environment that we are living in that I need to protect my own community because, you know, of the fear of the others. And all these are all interlinked to one another. You know, as I mentioned, you know, the politicians play a role, the different environment that we are raised in already, we are already in a certain sense of a community that, you know, we are here just to protect ourselves, defend ourselves, make sure we are not disturbed. That's all. And that's what happened. And I really feel very bad that, you know, people like us who are actually genuinely, we are okay, we are fine, we are all ostracized in that way. So again, this is not a fair thing, but have we actually get to understand the person as a human being? But why do we have to associate their race or their ethnicity inside all of that?
Dr. Ryan, perhaps the most important aspect to look at is government policies. What does your research have to say about our government policies? Are they as racist as some of the rhetoric on the ground suggests?
So this is actually, government policies is one of a new chapter we have included. In fact, we had tons of discussion internally in our team as well. But I have to put a disclaimer first. I'm in no sense an economic. My PhD is on psychology, so I understand behaviors, but not economics. But I will just try to explain a little bit in terms of all of this. Yeah. So when we talk in terms of government policies, I think for umpteen years, governmental agencies, or even the former Prime Minister Ismail Sabri, has mentioned that there is a need to strengthen Bumiputra. There is a need for us to have government policies aimed to strengthen and to elevate their status. Right? But the question then is that, are these policies effective? You know, we have the new economic policy, we have affirmative action since 1970s after the racial riot in 1969. And until today, you know, the sharing of the mean income in EPF earlier, it's a reflection that all these policies are not happening, you know? And the question then is that, why is it not effective, really, you know? And it really goes back towards the question of its effectiveness of race-based policies. In fact, we in Commerce, we have been calling for a needs-based approach instead of a race-based approach. Are race-based policies actually empowering the rich to make the rich becomes richer and make the poor becomes poorer? Again, that's where the problem is today. Now, a lot of them may say, okay, look, the Bumiputra today, the Bumiputras today are really in need of assistance. I do agree. But if we take a needs-based approach, looking at the data, looking at whatever we have, the needs-based approach will also assist them. Automatically, if it's a big majority of that, the needs-based approach would then assist them and to elevate them. And I really empathize with a lot of my Malay Muslim comrades because they are actually suffering. But have all these different actions, governmental policies which are put in place actually going to them? I don't think they are. And that's the issue that we are having today in our country today.
I also want to hone in on GE15 specifically because that's also something that you guys covered in your research. How much was racialized or religious rhetoric amped up during GE15? Are there any interesting findings?
Okay, so actually we have a specific section on 15 GE. But what we have done is to make it a little bit more spicy to a certain extent is to really look into the political parties and who actually plays these strategies. So, of course, as you mentioned, of course, racial religious rhetoric has been amped. In fact, if you look through the whole past 8 years of Commerce monitoring, the incidence of racism, racial discrimination, and xenophobia will go towards the highest when there's a general election. So it's a given thing. You know, it's a trend, okay? So now when we look at GE15, of course, the key points that we have seen is racial religious representation. There's also elements of fear-mongering and also the points where politicians use racial and religious supremacy as a key point. Now let's look into the use of racial or religious politics by political coalitions. So the incidents, PN has 9 incidents captured. Barisan Nasional has 8, GPS 3, Barisan and the others all have 1 each. Now, let's zoom in deeper a little bit, okay? So, PN actually uses the most that we can see from PN, it's on fear-mongering. So, they will say, right, okay, if other groups are taking over and all that kind of stuff, then the Malay Muslims will be affected. This and that. So, that's their strategy. But when you look in terms of racial or religious representation, that's where BN is. BN will say, look, I am there to represent your community. I'm there to represent your ethnic group. So you can see in that sense, like, okay, this is the strategy, quite interesting also to see and look at it sometimes. That actually the strategies used by PN is more in terms of using fear-mongering, and they also use the message of racial or religious superiority. And of course, sad to say, you know, their leaders have also been saying that, okay, if the other political parties are winning, then they'll be doing all this kind of stuff. So again, sometimes when you look at the patterns, I mean, PH themselves, there's one incident, of course, by Na Kong Meng again, which was captured. But of course, you know, he was making a claim that, you know, if PN take over, then we have Taliban rule in Malaysia. So it's also part of fear-mongering.
Right.
But when you look at all of this, it's quite interesting to really see that political parties themselves have their own strategies in terms of how they actually push it. And to be fair, fear-mongering sounds like it's working. It is right. Really working. That we can see the changes in the representation in parliament as well. And it's quite scary as well to see.
I want to go back to what you brought up earlier about how what happened during the British divide and rule. We continue to live in similar society, such as during the British era. And sometimes it's not just about we don't know who our neighbours are. like you mentioned, sometimes we don't really know who our friends are as well, because let's say an ICERT rally is happening. You go on Facebook and you're like, how come, you know, we are actually good friends or at least acquaintances? We interacted in school. Perhaps we played football on the same field. We had no problems there. Everything seemed fine. And how come our views on this particular thing is so diametrically opposed to one another? I'm wondering if one of the reasons this is the case is because we are not a country that deals with conflict. We are a country that says there is no conflict, don't talk about the conflict, let's pretend that everything is okay, let me just sweep it under the rug. Rather than let's looking at the reality on the ground, why is this happening? Why is this conflict happening? How can we bring people together and talk about their conflict in constructive ways rather than just tolerate, you know, each other or pretend that everything is going on? What are your thoughts on that?
So there are two ways that we can look at this, really. You know, the first way is that the policies, and I mean, I have to say this, you know, to a certain extent, when Comas has been engaging the government since 2008 until today, it's quite surprising to see that the Malaysian government actually measures harmony and peace through the number of protests on the street.
Wow.
That's mind-boggling, right? Yeah. So again, issues of race and religion are not covered in all of this. And we have been advocating and pushing for the need to do so. That's number one. Secondly, when we look at things as well, this is what Professor Ulong Shamsul Amri has said, that Malaysia is a stable tension. I to a certain extent, and we to a certain extent disagree with that, because, you know, it's a stable tension, because he's saying that, you know, we might have tension in one another, but it's still stable. There's no conflict, there's no fight, there's no take up arms. But for us as human rights organizations, we say that, look, you cannot wait to continue to hold attention. How long can you hold attention? We need to resolve, we need to have mediation to do so. And sad to say that in our country today, we do not have laws and we do not have groups of commissions to help mediate and to diffuse this tension. In fact, let's be frank, the Human Rights Commission, in our engagement with Suhakam, there's usually no reports on racism at all in their human rights violations. And it's like taken like it's a normal thing. And whenever it comes to race and religion, people will say, wait, it's sensitive, don't talk about it. And we need to move away from that. We need to have conversations like that, because these hard conversations are required for us to really understand another group. That's one. Then the next part is also that, you know, we do not have mechanisms. In fact, what we have in our laws and policies today is just like penal codes, sedition act, anything, anyone. So it's a very wide kind of law that you can use just to arrest anyone. And something that we don't want in our country. And that's another issue as well, you know. So we are calling for the establishment of a National Unity Reconciliation Commission. It was actually started back then in 2018 by the Pakatan Harapan government. There were discussions. In fact, I've seen the bill. And what had happened was, in that co-commission, there were also points where they said, okay, there should be a tribunal. There should be a mediation. So when there are hot cases like this, they will call together, commission will call both parties. Let's have a conversation to try to resolve this issue, which is a really good, nice model. Of course, Sheraton move happened. A lot of things happen, change in government, policies also change. The whole document got thrown into the rubbish. And what happened was a National Unity Blueprint. So when it comes to National Unity Blueprint by Muhyiddin's term, and then it was continued by Ismail Sabri, which is then reframed into the Keluarga Malaysia one. Again, I have to say that a lot of it's, I've seen those blueprints as well. Sad to say that it's a lot in terms of like, okay, we need to build this tolerance, we need to build the kind of understanding. And then at the top of it, they do not address the real issue of racism, racial discrimination. It means there's no acknowledgement of that. It's not that you ask us to balik any kampung. I have a place in China. I don't have. I tell you honestly, I don't have any. My home is here in Malaysia.
Right.
Huh? So again, when they have these kind of things, and when you have certain laws and policies, or even the National Unity Blueprint, which was supposed to address such issues, it's not all-encompassing. It favors one ethnic group, and that's really alarming. In fact, a lot of the things that they are having today, it's all not very superficial. You know, in fact, a lot of the work that was done by the National Unity Department is like, okay, let's bring together people from different ethnic groups together. Let's makan-makan together. Let's have nasi lemak and all that kind of stuff. After that, done, symbolic movement, poof, everybody go back home. Yeah, la, food, you can bring everybody together, but that's all. It's just that way. And we don't even build that kind of engagement, that kind of understanding of different ethnic groups, different religions. Right. And that's the sad state of a country today. Really, there are no commission, but we have been pushing. In fact, at this point of time, I have to say, you know, Commerce has been trying to engage with the Unity Minister, but he's been very busy. They will say, okay, we have Rukun Tetanggas, we have all these different mechanisms. Excellent. Really excellent. But have we actually talked about understanding each another as true Malaysians? We have not actually. You know, in fact, all their Rukun, most of their events are always jom makan, let's have a run together. After the run, it's like, okay, I see many different different ethnic groups, different cultural groups together. That's considered unity. But that's not, that's just artificial, that's just superficial, and we need to really find a way to really. So we are really calling for this new government to establish a National Unity Commission, like, cause like you mentioned, we need to have that conflict resolution. And till today, we don't have. The conflict resolution, unhappy, report police, report police, report police. Police also got other things to do, hello.
Right.
And that's the thing that we're having. So we have been consistent in our call to have a National Harmony Reconciliation Commission. But of course, putting the right people in this commission is also another different thing we have to talk about, because you have different, you know, we have some groups of people who are just there for other motives, then it's going to be very difficult.
I'd like to end this conversation by just asking you what your hope for the future is. We've talked a lot about how serious the situation is today, how it has been escalating over the years. Where do we go from here?
The first point for Malaysia is that we need to acknowledge that this is an issue that we need to address. In fact, I think now Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim's government is facing the brunt of it. So now they are saying, yes, we need to do something about it.
Right.
But again, my end goal and my hope, or what we hope in Pusat Commerce, is really that every one of us are treated equally as a true Malaysian. In fact, there shouldn't be much double standards. We have been living in this country for almost 65 years, right, or 70 years together. We are born and bred here. You know, we live this country, and nation building has to come together and collectively. And let's be frank, the issue of race and religion today has led and also contributed to brain drain in our country today. A lot of people have said that because they felt that they're not given equal opportunities. And we have seen the likes of Michelle Yeoh out there, you know. Imagine if Michelle Yeoh is to practice and to do whatever she's been doing here in Malaysia, would she be getting the Oscars to do? Sad to say, no. And that's where we are saying that, you know, it's easy for us to claim, oh, that claim, you know, this person is mine, this person is mine. It's very easy to that claim, you know. But really, are we giving that avenue to all Malaysians to flourish equally? And sad to say, in our country today, it's not. And it's always very targeted to specific sectors only. So our hope is that, you know, we hope that all Malaysians will be treated equally, move beyond race and religion. And I really hope and call for all Malaysians, call out your politicians. Really, you know, don't support them if they play the race and religious rhetoric. You know, we need to move beyond the race-based perspective. So we need to feel empowered as Malaysians. Don't give up hope in our country, because if we give up hope, then we are really going to be to meet our doom actually for our country. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Ryan.
Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to share our inputs and our views.
That was Dr. Ryan Chua, Program Director at Pusat Commerce. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can also check us out on podcasts. We are available on the BFM app, BFM.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashrin Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.